Now, I just want to thank all of you, by the way, for the amazing response we had to our interview with Ian and Marjorie McGarvey yesterday. We chatted to them for the last hour of the show. If you missed that, you can watch it back on my socials or on the Highland socials, and also you can listen back to it on the podcast. But it was lovely. A really, really nice interview. And from their perspective, and so many of you text in, too numerous to mention, but we will try and mention them as we get on. Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us very, very shortly. I'm going to take that break imminently. I just want to play a couple of requests here. Hi, just wondering, could you call out a request for Sadie Doherty? Hi, Sadie. Sadie is in the Lake House Nursing Unit in Dunfanaghy, and she's going to be 106 years young on Sunday. So happy birthday to you, Sadie. I hope you have a wonderful day on Sunday, and all the love in the world is coming from your niece, Mary Brogan, and family in Rye Rathmullen. Please wish a very big happy birthday to my lovely sister, Jacqueline Doherty, Maharamore Clonmany. Enjoy all the celebrations and party tonight. Lots of love from your sister, Marie, and nephew, Eamon, in Buncrana, and your nephew, James, in France. And Brooke Johnston in Glenmaquin. Brooke, 13 today. I love the name, Brooke. Lots of love coming in from Granny and Grandad Johnston. Right, okay, so I'm going to take this break now, give you the bingo numbers, and back with Seamus Gunn answering your legal questions and having a wee chat about stuff as well after these. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme, and welcome on to the programme now, Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Co, Remelton and Letterkenny. Good morning to you, Seamus. How are you keeping?
Morning, Greg. Yes, nice to be with you.
Good. Great to have you with us. And we are going to get to listeners' questions, of course, very, very shortly, but we do tend to talk quite a bit about American politics in a wee preamble before we get to those questions. It's been an eventful couple of weeks, to say the least.
Yes, yeah, it has. Yeah, we have the wave of red flying through Britain now, and is there going to be something similar come November in the US? The way things have developed over the last since we spoke 3 or 4 weeks ago, it's beginning to look a bit like that. But a lot can yet happen, and I'd like to think there's more to be played out in this, which is becoming a bit of a soap opera drama across the water. But I thought that if we were speaking last Friday after the aftermath of the Atlanta debate, it was pretty unedifying all round. I the handling of Joe Biden, maybe up to it and allowing him to be exposed to that situation, I think leaves a lot of questions to be answered. I was also shocked.
But can I just say one thing in relation to that?
The CNN presentation of it too.
Okay, but we'll get to that, Seamus. I want to say one thing though, is that, you know, that I've always struggled to articulate it for fear of to offending anyone. But I've had my concerns about the impact of his age, not his age, but age-related issues. But also, too, really, a lot of it was being covered up by the party, by certain networks, you know, by Democrats, a lot of people in the know that he was struggling to some extent to run a robust, coherent campaign. So really, the concern I don't have about CNN presentation, it's really the cover up of his failing ability to sort of be able to do what he needs to be doing.
Yeah, well it kind of supports my argument in the manner in which it was handled, first of all, by his advisors, to putting him into that situation, suspecting that he was in some way compromised. Now, the point I think you're making is, well, it should be out there and they can't cover this up. I do accept that. But I'm looking at it purely from the position of Joe Biden going out on that stage and then knowing that he's really not up for this. Now the man was after spending about 5 or 6 days in prep, seemingly. And he certainly lost the debate. But where he could lose it even worse is the way in which they've tried to explain why it happened afterwards. There's now a bit of a spin put on this, that it was due to fatigue. He admits he nearly fell asleep on the stage. Now, that just doesn't sound good. And then he was saying about he was around the world a couple of times in the weeks beforehand. But he was back a couple of weeks. So whenever he's due to actually do an interview, I think, today, and they're going to cover it all wall to wall now and live. ABC, I think, are doing it.
Oh, is it live?
And it's going. They're going to be putting him on the spot and making an trying to get an explanation as to what happened. Now, if he comes out with that, that just will not fly. And I can see him just digging a hole, a further hole for himself. But what it has done is this: if you look on the flip side and say, well, at least it has opened the debate about maybe somebody, and we've mentioned this before in your show, stepping into his shoes. It's not too late, and there would be a certain bounce in it. Interesting, though, on the debate itself, there wasn't a huge change in the poll thereafter as to the support. They were both still around the 40-odd percent. Now, obviously, in strongholds of Trump, he got a good bounce. But otherwise, it's still there or thereabouts. The dilemma they have is where they go from here. But think of it, if he was really on his game, and this is what is disappointing. If he was on his game that night, as in 4 years ago, he would have called out the lie after lie that came from Trump on all types of issues. And the one about calling in the National Guard, Nancy Pelosi, for Capitol Hill in 21, 10,000 guards on standby. That was just blatantly untrue. And it's been proven to be untrue. But and abortion and even the economy and the way... There was lots of stuff that Joe Biden could really have hit hard and exposed Trump. And that night, he just was not up for it. Now, is he fit to continue? Well, there's three or four big hitters, I think, over there, and they're looking at it. But the problem they have is they haven't groomed. A couple of years ago, I think we mentioned this maybe. Well, I might have mentioned that Kamala Harris, I thought, at that point, after a couple of years in, was going to be got ready for the next time round, 2024. Seemed to make sense to me now, and a younger person and all that. Now, she's probably the only lady, the only one in waiting that I can see that has a profile that's likely to give Trump a run for it, at least.
And John McAteer pointed out earlier on...
They shot themselves in the foot because they didn't do that.
And John McAteer pointed out earlier on in a brief conversation on this as well, is that she's the only one legally that has access to the war fund, you know, all the monies that's raised. I mean, Michelle Obama's name and what have you has been mentioned, but apparently to fund it, that pot of funding that's there could not be used in time, but it could be for Kamala Harris. So it is complicated for the Democrats.
It is complicated. But you see, while we are addressing this, and you've mentioned the ageism point, that cuts both ways. Let's be very fair about it. 78, 81, there's not an awful lot in this. But where the Democrats have again been disappointing, and again the advisors, I think, is the manner in which they have concentrated on the weakness of their own candidate heavily over the last 2 weeks. They run for cover before that debate was over. They were on Twitter and everything. Unmitigated disaster, I think, was used as before it was even finished. And he did get a bit stronger towards the end. Instead of at least trying to pull back, steady the ship, and look at what Trump was saying in that debate.
Yeah, but the Democrats wanted this early debate. There's never been a debate this early in any presidential campaign. Was it purposely done to expose Joe Biden with a view to putting someone else in his place? You know, a lot of this stuff goes on behind the scenes.
Cynical a view, and it would be one that probably a lot of people would share and would have good reason to share. And the other side of it is that, yes, because it's far enough out that if it went well and he did gain points against Trump on the night, as I said, if he was back 4 years ago, well, then it would be carry on business as usual. They're far enough out now to maybe make a change. Will it stop the Trump momentum? It's hard to see that, but it would get a certain bounce. And it's again going to be who people like least is going to win this election. And those swing states are up for grabs. And that's why he's in, I think, Wisconsin, or I think he may be at the moment for this debate with ABC. And that's probably going to be compulsive viewing for a lot of Americans. The balance is in the middle. And most people at this stage are so frustrated with both, they would like some alternatives.
Yeah. And you could make a very strong argument that the British election has just been decided on who you dislike least, really, if the truth be told.
Well, the British, yeah. Well, a big compliment to the exit polls, Craig, in Britain. Last night, just as an aside, at 10:05 last night, 10:05, they had the Labour seats at 410, and it's 411 this morning.
Not bad going, is it? But that's what happens when the media works together.
That's right, and that's a way. Yeah. But it's cyclical. The English politics is cyclical, because if we really look at it, the Conservatives could never win. They didn't do that terribly badly, really. It could have been worse. Like 5 years, 4 or 5 years ago, they said Labour was wiped out. Take forever to come back. Maybe never come back. Mm-hmm. That was what was said. Suddenly, Keir Starmer is in, and the red flag is.
But that circle, what's going to be interesting, though, is this time around, and you're 100% right as always, but this time around, that circle could be broken, because the Conservatives now have Reform breathing down their neck, and they have to decide what the Conservative Party is, because Reform are very much going to become and grow into the Conservative Party that Conservative voters want to vote for. I said earlier on, you know, Nigel Farage says he's coming after Labour. It's the Conservatives he's coming after, because it's they that are going to have to figure out what they are in the space of 3, 4, or 5 years.
Well, yeah, Nigel Farage will and is and continues and has in the past always beat a very big, loud drum. There's no doubt about that. But where the exit polls got it slightly wrong on last night's early doors, anyway, they had them, the Reforms, in at around 14. It looks like he's going to have about 4, maybe 5, maybe, but 4 anyway. So that's really not a heavy type of representation. So I think that that has sort of lost a little bit of the momentum, that, and that is really obviously a Brexit. That's the Brexit Party, which now became the Reform Party, mm-hmm. in the UK. But the Conservatives have only themselves to blame, really. Five leaders in 14 years.
Liz Truss gone, isn't she? Jacob Rees-Mogg gone, all the big hitters.
He's gone, he's gone. But Liz Truss, about a six-month prime minister, is gone. So there's people with some talent gone. Penny Mordaunt's gone, I think. Yes. They're saying so. Another. So their talent, they haven't got a great pool to pick from. Sunak will go. That's five in a row within, you know, a space of, you know, less than a decade. I think the rot set in with Brexit on it. Yep. And then from there on, it went downhill.
Now, before we get into questions, a lot of questions, as you know yourself, come in about inheritance tax and all that kind of stuff. We had Alan Shatter on, who's heading up a group looking for reform of inheritance tax. I think it seems to be one of the key pillars of the budget. Well, maybe not a key pillar, but certainly one of the headline changes that's expected to come down the line. Are you keeping an eye on that, or what are you anticipating, or is it a wait and see situation?
Well, inheritance tax, The thresholds for inheritance tax, believe it or not, I think have been last set, and they used to be revised annually with the budget, but I think they have remained in place, subject to correction. I'm not a tax consultant, but subject to correction, from 2019. So those thresholds haven't changed. But if you're in Dublin now, just for example, and you have own a dwelling house in 2019, and the threshold for a son or daughter who is inheriting that for inheritance tax purposes is 350,000. And thereafter, they're liable, unless they've lived in the house under certain exemptions that they might be able to look at. But anyway, is a tax threshold. After that is 33% after you use up your tax threshold. Now, that is totally unrealistic. And it also means that property for that family would probably have to sell it, because the tax implications are far too high. I mean, that 335 should be more like, in my view, 750, you know, to have something realistic there. It mightn't be just the same in the country, but it does apply and can apply in situations where you have large estates.
Why wouldn't it be inflation linked, I wonder? Or why wouldn't it be inflation linked? Do you know what I mean? So that the caps would follow the market.
Well, because in around 2008 we had the collapse and we needed money in, and they dropped the inheritance tax. It was at least upwards of 510 to 520 over a decade ago. So and it hasn't even got back to that level yet, and it's low lying fruit for any government. So it is. and it has to go through the revenue, so they get their cut of it as it stands at the moment. Those thresholds are totally out of date and do need to be reformed and to be updated to give people a fair chance.
First question, was just wondering about inheriting a site directly from grandparents. What tax would be associated with this? Is there a way to reduce this by going through a parent? Now, as I say, Seamus always quick to point out he's not a tax expert, but never dodges a question either.
It's fair, it's relevant, because we deal with transfers of property all the time, and this is obviously a situation where a grandparent is generously maybe given a site to a grandchild. Now, the point is this, I think. If they give it to their son or daughter first, their inheritance tax, I just mentioned, somewhere is around the 350 mark. The grandchild's is less than 10% of that, 32,500, right? So if the site's worth 50,000, the grandchild could be cut for 33% of above the threshold between the 17,500 and 33, whatever. So that type of money, if they transferred it first to the son or daughter, there'll be no tax implication on that, if it, you know, at this type of level for them, and then they could transfer it on to their son or daughter, and that higher threshold would then apply. That would be one way around it. There might be some exemptions as well to be claimed in relation to...
Do you have to hold that land for a certain amount of time before then you can sort of change the title again?
Well, you're supposed to retain it, for six. If it was a dwelling house now to be used and lived in, and it was farmland, that for six years. So it could be an issue. But also, there would be worth looking at if it was a dwelling house that they've been transferred and they were going to live in it and had lived in it. That might qualify them for the larger exemption. So they really would want to tease it out in advance, and it's no harm getting some tax advice on it, because tax planning is well worth the money.
I had a car collision and decided to put the damages through my insurer. The company sent out an assessor and wrote my car off. They then made the decision not to pay out, as I had made modifications to the vehicle, which I didn't notify them of. That I accept, but they continued to write off my car without notifying me. Can they do this?
Well, that's a very... very difficult and tricky situation for the individual. Firstly, of course, they can write off the car if it's insured, and that's their function. And then they're obviously, you would consider they're obligated to pay out on foot of that and to whatever the sum insured is. The problem here is, it seems to me, that it's indicated anyway, inferred, that there's been some form of a non-disclosure done by the person who is the contractor, the person who is covered by the insurance policy, who has the contract with the insurance company. Now, if that is a fundamental breach of the terms and conditions, which I would consider it may very well be, modifications to a car, I would say, should be declared, because there may be an added risk for the insurer. In other words, the premium might go up. If you've adjusted the engine or whatever, souped it up a bit, of course, the insurer is going to say, well, hold on a minute now, I'm at a greater risk here of having to pay out on this. So the premium that I would put against that is a good deal higher. So in this case, it seems that has not been disclosed, and they actually admit that. So they can't really now say, well, they want to gain by their own admission of carrying out an act which was not disclosed to the insurance company.
But they
didn't agree with. So they're in difficulties.
Yeah, but the issue, I think, here, though, is that the insurance company have officially written this car off. They may have been able said to our texter there, they might have said, look, the car has been modified, we're not going to cover the insurance and not write it off. So that would still allow the person to spend their own money to bring this car back into use. That's a part of this as well, too, that they wrote the car off, which is actually effectively a legal thing, but then says, right, we've destroyed you. Your asset's worthless now. It's scrap. And by the way, now we're not going to pay out either because you modified the car.
It's deemed a write-off, and that's where it would be at as far as any future insurer is concerned. But there's always the small print, Greg, in these policies and that. And in a situation such as that, if the insured has an issue, and they have an argument, Then in most policies, there's an arbitration clause that can be invoked by the insurer where they maintain that they've been shortchanged by the insurance company. And they can invoke that and go down that route. Or if they feel strong enough about it and think they can make the argument, they could look at the contract of insurance and then maybe raise some action in contract. I wouldn't be overly optimistic, but if they want to put money into it, so be it.
All right, quick one on a will here. I want to change my will. I also want to change solicitor. Can I go to a new solicitor and make a new will? And if I do, does that mean that the old will becomes void because a new will has been made?
Yeah, well, whenever new arrangements are put in place, one of the clauses in it at the very start is it's hereby revoke all former wills and or other testamentary dispositions at any time made by me. So that immediately eliminates any previous wills. So the fact that they go to an alternative representation or another solicitor or another advisor, that's everybody's privilege. They don't really need their old will at all. But once they put the new one in place, the old one then is void, it is revoked, and it will be the last will and testament. And that is why at the very start of a recital for a will, this is the last will and testament of whoever Joe Bloggs, etc. And it revokes any previous wills. And of course, there's plenty of lawyers out there, and that's what we all do. So they're quite entitled to go from to change solicitor and entitled to make a new will at any time.
Yeah, but there is also potential complications there, and the establishment of a national will database would eliminate a lot of that stuff. I know you're a big fan of that.
I beat that drum maybe a few years ago, but nobody's listening. There should be a central register. We have got that far with technology. I don't see it's beyond that. That whenever, for example, if you were giving me instructions on something, just as an example, that then that arrangement would be in place, and then that I could just register in a central database that Joe Bloggs has made arrangements, and just the date of it, no more, no less than that, so that it would be, there's probably, people might say, oh, it could be GDPR issues here, there could be this, there could be that, that sort of thing. But this would be very helpful, because you can have a situation, and it's quite common, somebody lives in Cork, I live in Cork, I moved to Donegal, I've made arrangements down in Cork, maybe change them up in Donegal. You know, there's no way of checking everyone's address and where they've lived or where they've been or what arrangements they may or may not have put in place. And that can give rise to issues, obvious issues.
Okay.
So, and duplication, etc. So, yes, a central register would go a long way towards solving that.
Just time for one more. There's a house next door to my mother. Her neighbour sprays cars. He put a fan out the garage and the fumes are stand clear. We reported it to the EPA, but they came back saying everything is within acceptable guidelines. Where do we stand regarding the fumes? And you know how these smell, it would be tight. The fumes make my mother unable to sit out in her own garden. You can't even burn rubbish anymore. So how is he allowed to spray the fumes? So obviously this is a spray room, and there's an extractor fan, and that's probably going through filters, who is to say. And that output is sprayed in the direction of the mother's garden. Can't sit outside. The fumes, you know, are bad.
It doesn't make for good neighbours, Greg. It's something that you would hope that common sense would prevail. If it doesn't, as a result of the being exposed to toxic fumes, maybe as they're described in this case, and that results in an individual becoming ill, sick, or otherwise, and they can link it to that, there could be a situation where it could give rise to a type of a claim in tort for damages, something that should be borne in mind at least. It might be a difficulty in proving that. But what they do say, which concerns me, is they did make a report of it, and that the levels or whatever were must have been taken and assessed by the EPA, and they have found it within reasonable levels. So that would be given a rise to a bit of an issue if you're ever going to go down the legal route and claim damages. But if it goes to that and you have a situation such as that, they should seek their go to along to their attorney, maybe a solicitor's letter, maybe somebody that can go and talk to the neighbour Are they going to put legal, you know, fees into this? Maybe the neighbour might want to be caught up in a legal wrangle. So that's the route. But some form of dialogue. Otherwise, this could escalate and cost everybody a great deal of money. Yes. There has to be experts involved and expert engineers to measure that type of toxicity.
Yeah, tricky. And you'd also have to sort of prove that the EPA weren't wrong in their considerations. It's a toughie. Seamus Gunn. Yeah, Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Co. Remelton at Ada Kenny physical offices there. And of course, an online present. You're all over the internet, Seamus.
Yes, well, I don't say all over.
Well, you've got two websites.
Yeah, keep it simple, gun.ie, and everyone get to Remelton in the next 10 days because it will be lively.
Yes, I'm trying to convince people to let me go or come with me. All right, Seamus, thank you very much indeed. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company. Not surprised, Greg, that you let a former Fine Gael senator dismiss Aintu as a political party. Need to remind you of the vote the party got locally and nationally in the local elections and what it will achieve in the next. They may be small now, but watch this space. I'm not the thought police. And she said that she was surprised that her friend, with her particular views, vote for Aintu. So let's not be too sensitive here, all right? That's just someone's opinion. Right, Dr. Anne Devlin, author of a report, COVID-19 Infection Rates and Social Disadvantage in Ireland, an Area Level Analysis. Dr. Anne's with us now. Good morning to you, Anne. Thanks for your time.
Morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's good to have you on. Now, I suppose I'm going to focus more on the Northwest here, if that's okay. The report did have a couple of headlines, of course. It found COVID-19 infection rates were more than a third higher in the most deprived areas of Ireland relative to more affluent areas. Those issues in terms of, you know, those who might be more inclined to use public transport and what have you. But is there anything that stands out for you from a border stroke Northwest perspective?
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. That's great to be talking to you who are living in that area about the findings. So as you said, we set out to look at COVID infection across Ireland and how it related to deprivation. And we find those higher rates in particular areas. So initially we mapped it, and just looking at a map, I've posted it on Twitter, we could see these higher rates were really in and around the border. So Donegal, but right down, you know, and we know there's higher deprivation in Donegal, but right down into Louth and Monaghan, we've seen really consistent, pretty high rates of COVID. So when we went on then to do our econometric model, and I'll not bore everybody with that today, we've seen that that was consistent. And what's interesting is while we find higher COVID rates in deprived areas across Ireland, in and around the border, it's actually the non-deprived areas we see these higher COVID rates. So it's a wee bit maybe what we hadn't really anticipated.
Can I throw a theory in there, if that's okay? At the peak of COVID, when there were very strict restrictions in place, the place with the highest infection rates was in Northern Ireland and the northwest of Northern Ireland, and people were allowed to move freely across the border whilst there were great restrictions everywhere else. Do you know what I mean? So say Dublin South couldn't go into Dublin North and all that kind of stuff. But at that time, the policy was is that people in Northern Ireland could come into the Republic, mostly border counties, drive around and do whatever they want. And often, obviously, they would arrive in perhaps more affluent areas where pubs, restaurants or whatever, that type of stuff was available, in and out of shops and all that type of stuff. There were varying rules on masks, and many of them weren't wearing masks, but I'm not going to get into the debate on masks. So my suggestion would be that would be a strong indicator as to why we saw higher rates, because I was tracking it quite closely and I could see the holiday areas, right? Your likes of your Downing's areas, West Donegal, they were having much higher rates than parts of the county, like, say, for instance, Killybegs, Donegal Town, where there wouldn't be as much tourism traffic from the north.
Yeah, I think it's definitely one aspect of it. So we looked at the border counties. We also looked closer to the border. So I think it's part of it, but it's not the whole story. I think there's numerous things going on. So even cross-border workers, we did a totally different study recently in cross-border working, and there's issues there about working from home. So there's people in Donegal potentially with professional jobs or whatever in Derry or other northern areas, and there we're maybe still having to go to work. So then that means they're in an office, they're stopping for a sandwich or to fill up with diesel. So there's just more chances of transmission. Also, a lot of south to north workers work in healthcare. So again, you know, they're in the front line, they're essential workers. So again, more chance of transmission of the virus. So a whole range of things. There's another study, a qualitative study was done, and they said they found around the border when they spoke to people, there was issues, you know, people around the border, there's a lot of interdependencies, you know, different schools, different jobs, you know, a lot of crossing across between the north and south. And they found that people around the border, they were aware of both sort of public public health messages that were coming through. So even when restrictions were the same, the public health messaging about the rationale and the why differed.
Yeah.
And when the rationale differed for people, they maybe just weren't, they didn't have the same buy-in.
There was a very short period of time where, in my view, where the public health rules in the north and south aligned. We felt at that time that the border was too complicated to sort out, right? And that these were measures that were brought in for the majority. But there were clear gaps that for all the reasons we were doing the right reasons, there were clear gaps for the border areas. And it was like, well, what can we do? They have a different policy and what have you. I just would hope that studies like this and others catch that as well, because it is, and I suspect you know this, it is, there's a lot of things that relate to the border that just get forgotten to in national policy, even returning plastic bottles. You know, we go into Strabane, but you know what I'm on about, like, and the policies don't
really... Absolutely,
we
have really, the different lids now.
Yeah, exactly, and the policies don't really necessarily talk to border life. But so, just generally speaking, maybe go national on this one, why might areas of deprivation, do you think, be more prone to high rates of infection?
Yeah, again,
a whole host of reasons. You know, people in these areas, again, it's the jobs they work in, unable to work from home, more likely to be in retail or in hospitals and healthcare settings.
Hospitality
when it was open, yep. More likely to rely on public transport, more likely to maybe have to rely on informal care. You know, we're thinking of single parent households. They couldn't just, if they had to work, they had to take the children to their granny and vice versa. More people in houses, less bathrooms, you know, just less space even within the household to sort of, if one person had the virus, it was more likely to get spread. And we see particularly high rates in areas with more Irish travellers, and obviously huge issues there for them. We had a lady spoke about it yesterday about the issues they faced, and higher rates in places with communal establishments. So your nursing homes, direct provision centres, them sorts of places. So, you know, just living environments where it's harder to keep apart.
Yeah, and you would hope this information is analysed by decision makers and hopefully can help form policy and what have you into the future. Because we're talking about the spread of this one particular infectious disease, but does it also relate to the instances of flu in the population or chickenpox or measles or whatever it might be? You know, there are perhaps, and I know we're living in a different world where everyone's out and about, but I think it's well worth taking on board and studying to see what the ripple effects of this might be.
Absolutely. And even in terms of
COVID, you know, we've seen the last couple of weeks about how the rates are, but, you know, we're maybe not seeing it with testing and so on, but they're seeing it in the hospitals. And we're quite clearly back into another quite high period of COVID again. But yeah, it really applies to anything that's going to transmit between people.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you so very much indeed, Dr. Anne Devlin, author of that report, COVID-19 Infection Rates and Social Disadvantage in Ireland, an area level analysis. I'm not a massive fan of talking about COVID really, but just to be clear, and it's often buried deep in an article, that whatever COVID's going around now, it's not a strain of concern. It's not leading to any increase in admission to ICUs or what have you. But anyway, so as I say, that's often buried deep in the article because it's the headline that sells. I think it's disgraceful. A solicitor and former senator made a calculated comment about AIMTU without being pulled up on it. To imply that a friend wasn't educated because she chose to vote AIMTU is shocking. No, that's not what was said, you see. And I think AIMTU are going through, and its supporters are going through a process that I've seen with other parties in the past. AIMTU are not beyond reproach. What she said was, is AIMTU can have their position on subjects, and that's fine, and they'll get their votes where they get the votes or not. What she said is that she knew her friend's belief systems, right? And her friend's belief systems would not necessarily align with AIMTU policy. And that is what she was surprised at. She never says anything negative about AIMTU, as far as I was concerned. What she said is that she believed her friend had certain liberal views in certain areas, what have you, that don't necessarily align to AIMTU. And that's all that was said. Nothing more. And why should I pull her up and say, oh, well, your friend should know better? There's nothing for me to pull up on that. I'm not, as I say, the opinion police. That was her opinion of her friend. She was surprised that she would vote for AIM2 because from the knowledge of her friend has different outlook on certain things such as potentially abortion and what have you. A caller says, since I pay 15-cent tax on a plastic drinks bottle, is it legal that I should be refused my legally entitled refund if the bottle is damaged? The tax has been paid. Similarly, if I find plastic bottles discarded in the hedgerow, what incentive is there for me to pick it up if it's damaged? How strict are those machines? You know, obviously, we're pumping them through, as many of you are, but I don't know how restrictive are they in terms of damage. What's your experience been there? Thank you, John McAteer. You tell it as it is, talking about it, putting it on paper, but then there's no will to carry it through. Health and housing, do we encourage our young to return if we don't have these up to a standard as other countries with this government? Talk is cheap. We need a change, says a listener. Sports capital grants, their announcements are not expected till autumn. They were announced in February last time, 100% holding back till election time. Ask that woman what is wrong with being pro-life and anti-abortion. She never says anything was wrong with it. She just says that her friend wasn't and was voting for a party that was. Greg, I will vote for whoever lays out a plan that can sort out the health system going forward. Throwing money into it does not work. Bring back old health boards and have people in charge of each that are accessible and accountable with the ability to go out and entice doctors and consultants into Ireland. I do not want to give away a budget to gather votes, says them. They want investment in and reform of services, which I think I might be more inclined. The climate change scaremongering is just the next scam to control us. The earth is and always has been in a constant state of change. Of course, everyone should try and keep their own doorstep in order as far as is practical. We in Ireland have no influence of what's happening in China, India, America. The list is endless. Well, I mean, there's weather, right? Weather is what's happening now. Climate is what happens over a period of time. I'm getting a bit peed off with the lack of summer. You know, dry winters, cold winters, wet summers, cold summers, windy summers. Is that just the weather? Is that climate change? Joined on the programme by Jodie. Hi, Jodie.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. How's Benson?
Benson is wonderful. Proper little trooper and capturing everyone's hearts, I think.
All right. So Benson came into your life on Friday. He was called Benson by you after he was discovered in Buncrana. And you put the appeal out to try and get its owner, mm-hmm. his owner, to come forward, but there's no microchip and no sign of that owner coming forward. So what's next?
So he's had a very big week, bless him. He was found in a terrible condition. He's either been living rough for a very long time or he's not been treated very well. He's got broken teeth. He looks as though he's had hot oil poured across his back, oh, which no. has caused a lot of skin damage. He had signs of cancer, infections and everything. So he's a very poor little man. Estimated to be over about over between 10 and 12, really, we've been told. Mm. So he had his first operation on Wednesday, where he was in for over 3 hours in surgery to remove cancers and do various different things to him. And he's been a new man since. He's still got a lot of treatment and a long way to go to be fully fit. But he's just wonderful, such a character, and every day more personality is coming out about
him. For sure, and of course, Jodie, it's clear you're not giving up on him, but to get him back to good health is expensive, yeah. isn't it? And you're asking the kind public if they want to contribute. The bills will rack up quite quickly by the sounds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we already have 3 rescue dogs at home as it is, so it's crazy at home. Our other dogs are insured, so should something happen with those, you know, we know that we're covered with them, but obviously because of his age and the condition he was found in, he is uninsurable. So, you know, I wanted to make it clear, it's not that we're being irresponsible. It's something that we can't insure him going forward. And obviously it was a surprise. We weren't expecting him to come in, so we hadn't planned for these expenses. But I definitely, you know, we've had a couple of messages saying, oh, why don't we just put him to sleep? But I think he's obviously quite a fighter to still be here. But it's definitely, you know, he deserves that chance to fight on and be a healthy, happy dog for however long he's got left.
Yeah, indeed. Everyone, everything deserves a chance, doesn't it? And fair play for what yous are doing. And how do people find the link to the GoFundMe page if they want to throw a couple of euro your way to support you and Benson?
So the best way to find it is through the Lost and Found Bunkrana Facebook page. There's a link to the GoFundMe in there.
Sorry to cut across you, Jodie. I just want to make sure we don't misguide people. It's specifically Lost and Found Dogs Bunkrana, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah. And they've been amazingly supportive. It was them that posted that, you know, he'd been spotted last week, and it was through them that we arranged to go down and try and catch him. And it was, they'd then been getting a lot of people contact wanting to sort of support and help in some way. So it was suggested that we started this GoFundMe, which has been amazing. I think this morning we were on about €1,300,
oh, wow.
which is quite overwhelming, really, that people have been so kind. But obviously that doesn't go very far when you're looking at multiple operations, medications and ongoing treatment and things. But we're so grateful for the support and positivity around him. As I say, it's quite overwhelming.
Okay. Well, if you want to back Jodie and Benson, get onto the Facebook page of the Lost and Found Dogs Bunkrana. You'll see the links there. You'll see the pictures. He looks like he's been to Turkey now. The teeth have been fixed, have they?
Absolutely. He's got, you know, fresh set of white teeth, looking all lovely. He's had a fresh haircut. When he first was picked up, he looked like he was a Shih Tzu. Now he's been cut, he looks more like a Yorkshire Terrier.
Now he looks
so
like a great
Sue. So we think he's a cross between the two.
Okay, yeah. Listen, brilliant stuff. Well done, Jodie, and the work you do with the animals as well. It's obviously
you
have other animals with you. The best of luck. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.